Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1200, I will have four segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, including the ongoing Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. After that, I will air the remarks of Palestinian journalist Shuruq Al-Ayla, addressing from Gaza the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. During the third segment, I will air the testimony of a genocide survivor, Dr. Haider Eid, Associate Professor of Literature and Cultural Studies at what used to be Al-Aqsa University in Gaza, before apartheid Israel destroyed it. Speaking at the Gaza Tribunal final session held in Istanbul, Turkey, in October 2025. During the Israeli genocide on Gaza, Dr. Ra'id lost 54 relatives, 39 colleagues from Al-Aqsa University, and over 280 students, including his best literature students, as well as his apartment, neighborhood, family home, children's school, and university. During the fourth segment, I will air the remarks of Dr. Javed Abdelmenam, emergency medicine physician and Medecins Sans Frontières International President, addressing the Gaza Tribunal final session on destruction of healthcare system, bearing witness to genocide in Gaza. He bears witness to Israel's deliberate mass harm of civilians, use of food as weapon of war, and destruction of healthcare system as three key elements in its genocide in Gaza. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 832 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip, while the Israeli blockade remains firmly in place despite nearly 100 days since the so-called ceasefire was agreed upon in October 2025. On Wednesday, the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza announced that since the agreement, at least 450 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,200 have been injured. Also on Wednesday, Hatem Abu Saleh, a nurse, was killed by Israeli occupation forces in Khan Yunis. Reporter Tamer Keshta recorded footage of his family, colleagues, and loved ones grieving over his body, which was taken to the Nasser Medical Complex, where he was a member of the nursing staff. Dr. Mohammed Sakhar, the director of the nursing department where Abu Saleh worked, told TRT World News that Abu Saleh was the target of more than one assassination attempt and had already sustained injuries while on duty inside the hospital complex. He had taken a leave from work to help his family prepare for his son's wedding. But, quote, the occupation's bullets were faster than his chance to attend. Dr. Sakhar added, quote, today we bid farewell to our colleague who never hesitated to serve these afflicted people. The occupation is deliberately targeting medical and nursing staff. We have lost dozens of nurses and doctors in a very short period of time. On Tuesday, January 13th, two Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces in Rafah. The day before, on January 12th, an Israeli quadcopter drone shot and killed three Palestinians in Khan Yunis, identified by the local Wafa news agency as Wissam Abdullah Salem Al-Amur, Mahmoud Subhi Breka, and Atef Samir Al-Bayouk. The attacks came after Israeli army forces carried out airstrikes and shelling across several parts of the enclave on Monday, Al Jazeera noted. Faris Afana, the director of emergency and medical services in Gaza, said this week that Israel continues to violate the ceasefire every single day, leaving civilians under constant fire across Gaza. He reported that four Palestinians were killed on Sunday, January 11th, in Gaza City and other areas, with multiple injuries reported, and that a civilian was shot in the back in Jabalia refugee camp. Afana added that, quote, Israeli occupation snipers are still committing massacres against our Palestinian people. James Elder, the spokesman of the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, who is in Gaza, stated this week while sitting next to the hospital bed of a 9-year-old child that the agency has recorded reports of at least 100 children killed by Israeli attacks and hundreds more wounded during the so-called ceasefire. The child, Abdel Rahman, said he was collecting firewood and plastic when an Israeli missile struck the area he was in, sending a 6-millimeter thick piece of shrapnel into his eye. He says, quote, I want to play with my friends in the neighborhood. They play while I cannot.
I want to watch this video. I don't want to film this video. And certainly little Abdel Rahman wishes he was at home, safe. More than 100 children have been killed in Gaza since the ceasefire of early October. That's roughly one girl or boy killed every day during a ceasefire. Hundreds, like little Abid al-Rahman, have been wounded. A ceasefire that slows the progress of bombs is progress, but one that still buries Palestinian girls and boys is not enough. This is the moment to turn reduced violence into real safety for children. Open full access for aid, dramatically expand medical evacuations, and turn this into the line where the killing of girls and boys in Gaza finally stops.
That was James Elder of UNICEF. Along with deaths and injuries from bombings, drone strikes, and missile attacks, Israel continues to deprive Palestinians of the right to basic shelter and safe housing, while it weaponizes the winter weather as another instrument of death and misery. Journalist Wissam Shabat filmed the effect of the recent high winds on tent shelters across the beach on Tuesday. The United Nations Humanitarian Office stated on Tuesday that hundreds of tents and makeshift shelters were blown away or heavily damaged in brutal wind and rainstorms over the last few days, and that its office has received reports of cases of hypothermia, mainly among children, and people killed as buildings collapse. Reporter Saeed Hezbollah filmed a building collapsing in the Sheikh Radwan neighborhood of Gaza City on Wednesday evening. The home fell apart, as he says, quote, due to the poor condition of the infrastructure damaged by the war, as well as the heavy rain and strong winds that has hit the Gaza Strip. Israel has refused to allow in necessary materials for infrastructure repairs and maintenance, as well as heavy equipment to clear the vast piles of rubble. And of course, prefabricated caravans and other shelter materials that remain stockpiled on the other side of the Gaza crossings. On Tuesday, the Palestinian Civil Defense reported that at least three people, including a 15-year-old girl, were killed when a building collapsed in Gaza City. Another person was killed in a separate collapse in the city on the same day, and the health ministry reported that at least one Palestinian died when a building toppled on Wednesday, bringing the number of deaths from such incidents to 25 since the beginning of the winter season. Deaths from hypothermia were also reported across Gaza this week due to Israel's defiance of its obligations to allow in caravans and shelter materials. A one-week-old infant named Mahmoud al-Aqra was brought to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah on January 10th. Reporter Samer al-Boji filmed the baby's older brother, who spoke with harrowing grief about how they called the ambulance after feeling the baby's cold leg. The boy says, quote, we don't have anything but blankets. We wrapped him with the blankets so he could keep warm. We don't have enough blankets or anything. The covers we had were just shawls, and this is what happened to him. A one-year-old baby, also in Deir al-Balah, died in his displaced family's tent on Tuesday, according to medical sources at the hospital. Two other children had died on Monday night due to the freezing conditions and inadequate shelter, Al Jazeera Arabic reported. The Gaza government media office stated on January 13th that since the start of the genocide, At least 24 Palestinians have died from extreme cold in the forced displacement camps, 21 of whom were children. Meanwhile, because of Israel's ongoing blockade and more than 2 years of bombings to most of the infrastructure, municipal workers are warning that destroyed or degraded sewage and water systems across Gaza could create unprecedented health and environmental crises. Our contributor Asim Al-Nabi, reporting beside a reservoir for Al Arabi TV on January 13th, said that, quote, "This is one of the consequences of a long-term catastrophic genocidal war. The basin was originally designed to collect rainwater and recharge the groundwater. Today, it is contaminated with vast amounts of sewage, posing a grave threat to Gaza City's groundwater and creating an environmental crisis that may take years or perhaps decades to resolve." Asim is not only a writer for the Electronic Intifada and a reporter with Al Arabi TV in Gaza, but he is also the spokesperson for the Gaza municipality. The Gaza government media office stated on January 9th that as the Israeli government continues to renege on its obligations under the October 10th agreement, the Gaza Strip is, quote, facing a slow-motion genocide. According to reports, Israel has only allowed in 43% of the minimum agreed upon quantities of humanitarian aid, which has led to a, quote, continued severe shortage of food, medicine, water, and fuel, and has deepened the catastrophic humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip. Even the food items that the occupation allows to enter are mostly of low nutritional value, while the occupation prevents the entry of nutritious and essential food items, confirming that the occupation is deliberately pursuing a systematic policy of starvation and deprivation. Furthermore, the media office said, fuel shipments to the Gaza Strip during the same period have only averaged about 5 trucks per day out of the 50 trucks allocated according to the agreement. This represents a compliance rate of approximately 11%, they say, quote, leaving hospitals, bakeries, and water and sanitation facilities in a state of near paralysis and exacerbating the suffering of the civilian population. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces stormed the Batin al-Hawa neighborhood of Silwan in East Jerusalem on Wednesday, assaulting and beating residents, firing sound bombs and tear gas, causing damage to people's personal belongings inside their homes and detaining at least one man, according to the Wafa news agency. The attacks follow recent forced expulsions of Palestinian families from their homes in Silwan and the imminent expulsion of approximately 24 more families, which are part of a broader effort to expel some 2,200 Palestinians from Silwan, Middle East Eye said. As we reported last week, Israeli forces expelled families from their homes in Silwan and turned the buildings over to an extremist Jewish Israeli settler organization. Also in East Jerusalem, Israeli forces ordered the month-long closure of a health clinic in the Old City and threatened to cut water and electricity if it reopens and provides care for patients. The Al-Zawiya Clinic, which is the oldest clinic run by UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, has, since 1949, provided essential services including pediatric and maternal care. It serves 30,000 people. The clinic offers family planning services, mental health care, treatment for chronic diseases such as hypertension and diabetes, an emergency department, and dental care, according to Wafa, which notes that family planning, childhood vaccinations, and mental health services are available to both refugees and non-refugees. These moves are part of a wide escalation of attacks by Israel on the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees and the people it serves. Roland Friedrich, the director of UNRWA's affairs in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, stated on January 13th that, quote, in a disgraceful move, Israeli security personnel forcibly entered the UNRWA Jerusalem Health Center, demanding the removal of UN signage. The Jerusalem Health Center has been supported over decades by member states, many of whom have visited the premises. Later on the same day, a temporary closure order was issued against the health center, closing it for the next 30 days. It may never open again, he said. The developments, he said, quote, follow the December 2025 amendments made to the anti-UNRWA Knesset laws. These shameful tactics are part of the relentless campaign by Israeli authorities to unilaterally prevent UNRWA from executing its UN General Assembly mandate in occupied East Jerusalem, which does not fall under Israeli sovereignty. The application of Israeli law therein is illegal, he said. Israeli forces raided a Palestinian wedding in Jerusalem on January 9th, firing live ammunition and stun grenades at attendees. Several men were arrested, including the groom, with footage showing soldiers inside the hall and security forces throwing stun grenades as guests were forced outside, Al Jazeera reported. In the southern occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot a 58-year-old man, Shakir Falah al-Jabari, on Saturday, January 10th, as he was inside his vehicle in the eastern part of the city of Al-Khalil, or Hebron. Al-Jabari died from his wounds on Sunday morning, according to reports. The Israeli army said its forces opened fire at a vehicle that accelerated towards soldiers. However, in a later statement, the military acknowledged that an initial review found no evidence that the incident was an intentional attack. Israeli authorities confiscated his body following the shooting, the Wafa news agency reported. The Palestine Red Crescent Society told Al Jazeera that its crew was prevented from reaching the man. The killing came as Israeli forces besieged a house in the old city of Nablus on Sunday, with undercover units infiltrating neighborhoods before military vehicles stormed the city from multiple directions, Al Jazeera noted. Two Palestinians were arrested as troops deployed across several areas and live gunfire echoed through the Eastern Market, according to Palestinian security sources cited by Wafa News Agency. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada this week, but we wanted to highlight Fate of Gaza's Disappeared Remains Unknown by our colleague, the newest addition to our staff, the brilliant reporter, our assistant editor, Khaled Al-Hissi. On October 19th, 2025, Gaza's Ministry of Health announced it had received 150 bodies from Israel, Khaled writes. The corpses were handed over by the International Committee of the Red Cross, and their return followed the ceasefire agreement that came into effect on October 10th, with at least 8,000 people still missing in Gaza, presumed either buried under rubble in mass graves dug by the Israeli military, or detained by Israel and held outside Gaza, determining the fate of the missing is a top priority. But as Israel still keeps crossings into Gaza shut to all but the bare minimum of aid, Gaza's authorities are without heavy machinery to shift millions of tons of rubble or relevant scientific materials to properly identify sometimes deeply decomposed corpses. This undermines the effort to provide information to families of the disappeared. It was left to the forensic teams at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis to examine and document the corpses that were returned in October. The bodies were bound from the hands and ankles and had abrasions and bruises all over, Ahmed Diyar, director of the Forensic Medicine Department in Gaza, said in an October 20th interview with Palestine TV. Some bodies were naked except for their underwear. Others were fully naked, he said. Diyar added that the bodies had all been frozen, preventing the forensic teams from performing autopsies until the tissues thawed after 2 days. Two bodies, he added, had been blindfolded and had constraints around their necks. Others bore signs of physical abuse. Several bodies had gunshot wounds to the head and chest, he said, suggesting that they may have been executed. Some were just skeletons, while others were in an advanced state of decomposition. The Israeli side provided 90 DNA profiles along with the 150 bodies, but no names. Yet the Gaza Strip, as Israel is well aware, lacks equipment and tools for DNA or tissue analysis. We only have a rudimentary procedure relying on the body's length, trying to specify the age, the nutritional status, the presence of personal belongings, from the teeth, the bones, previous surgeries or amputations, distinguishing marks on the body like scars or moles in distinctive locations only the family can recognize, Diyar said. Providing DNA profiles is futile as a result, he said. based on the October so-called ceasefire agreement, Israel was to hand over bodies according to a 15-to-1 ratio, 15 Palestinians for every Israeli. As of January 2026, the Ministry of Health in Gaza had received 345 bodies, from which, so far, only 99 have been identified. DR explained the process of identifying these bodies in a video published by Gaza's Ministry of Health on October 14th. Forensic teams examined the bodies to determine the cause of death, how long since death, and the types of injuries suffered. A criminal evidence team then documents and photographs these injuries along with the body's general features and clothing. These photos are uploaded to a website created by the Ministry of Health in Gaza, where people can view the photos to try to identify the corpses. If someone recognizes a body, they head to Nasser Medical Complex to view the photos again. After confirming that it is the right body and that they have a close relationship or are relatives, they are allowed to take the body for burial. If a corpse is not identified, it will be buried in a designated location where every grave is numbered, a mass grave for unidentified martyrs. In case someone later identifies a body from photos, they will know where their loved one was buried. Those are excerpts from Fate of Gaza's Disappeared Remains Unknown by our colleague Khaled El-Hissi on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. In the Sawarha displacement camp in central Gaza, an animal therapy expert brought two rescued puppies to play with children. The Samir Project, a local mutual aid group which supports the camp and its residents, says, quote, "Animals bring happiness and purpose. They do not judge. They love unconditionally. This is so important, particularly at our medical camps, where we rehabilitate those with injuries and care for the sick. Our two new puppies will bring happiness amidst the pain." That's from the Samir Project in Gaza. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. On November 25, 2025, the UN Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People held a special meeting at the UN headquarters in New York to commemorate the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People. Palestinian journalist Shuruq Al-Aila, a widow and mother who lost her husband, Palestinian journalist Rushdi Sarraj, during the Israeli genocide on Gaza. Let's listen to her talk titled, "I Turned Out to Be a Story Myself."
Dear everyone, this is Shuruq Al-Aila, a journalist based in Gaza Strip. I'm 31. I'm the widow of the most adorable, caring, loving partner and husband, journalist Rushdi Sarraj, who got killed in the second week of the genocide. We have a little baby. She was 11 months old when she lost her father. I've pulled her twice from under the rubble, and this is such a nightmare that I cannot take it out of my mind. Being a journalist here in Gaza, documenting the violence, the non-stopping bombardment, the brutal reality on the ground, being running for survival, for food, for drinkable water, for everything. It is so heavy. It is so devastating to endure every all of those things together at once. It was never easy to go to do some coverage, leaving my daughter behind along with my siblings, but not knowing if I will ever return to her or not because of the systematic targeting of journalists. As the during the genocide, we have lost plus 20-50 the fellow journalists, whether they were under duty or they were with their families. It's heartbreaking that the press vest like has been marked as a threat. People are now recognizing journalists as a source of threat and a camera as a weapon. I've lived in a tent in like for 6 months, and that was one of the things that I don't want even to remember. Those tents, they never protect you from the burning sun or the heavy water rain or strong storms, winds, whatever. And having all of your stuff packed in plastic bags because you don't have a space. And even if you got a stuff, you are kind of lucky to have a stuff because the majority of the people here have lost the most of their belongingness here. I've lost my home. I'm one of them. During the genocide, we have called several times for international media to enter Gaza, for the foreigner journalists to enter Gaza. But unfortunately, they did not actually made the required or this expected pressure on the media to come here to Gaza to help during the devastating reality. We needed them actually, and we still need them till this moment. We are almost 2 months after the ceasefire, and still we are living in the half war, half peace, because borders are still closed. There is no freedom of movement. That's why I'm here. I'm participating virtually. I cannot be in person in this. And there are still we are talking about 2 years of coverage, day and night. And definitely we are super exhausted and tired, and we have lost all of us. We have lost something or many things. And this is another call for internationals to make more pressure for the media outlets to make more pressure in the media to come to Gaza, because I know that the Israeli army is still blocking them to enter, but there is a must in this, that there should be media campaigns to advocate for such thing. What I want to add that the war has been ended, but another war that just started at the same moment of the declaration of the ceasefire, the war of navigating life among the destruction, the mass destruction. We are navigating life within rubble. We have mountains of rubble. Until this moment, nothing happened on the ground in terms of rebuilding and reconstructing. And there are many aid are still blocked to enter Gaza. It's not easy to recall all of that things together, those things that they are chasing us all the time, but you try as much you can to not surrender such feelings, but it's really it's quite heavy to endure all of these things, and yet you are still having the sense of war hovering within the air that you are breathing, because still there are many complications and restrictions, and those who left us, they are not returning by the end of the war. I'm sending you all lots of hugs from Gaza, and I really appreciate your time for being here and for joining this and for giving a place for my voice, and I'm one one voice from 2 million people here. I've remembered that as a journalist that I've used to feature stories, but then I turned out to be a story myself. Thank you.
That was Palestinian journalist Shuruq Al-Ayla addressing the UN Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People, speaking from Gaza. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During the Gaza Tribunal final session held in Istanbul, Turkey in October 2025, Dr. Haider Eid, Associate Professor of Literature and Cultural Studies at what used to be Al-Aqsa University in Gaza, before apartheid Israel destroyed it, delivered his testimony of a genocide survivor. Dr. Eid lost 54 relatives, 39 colleagues from Al-Aqsa University, and over 280 students, including his best literature students, as well as his apartment, neighborhood, family home, children's school, and university. Let's listen to his testimony.
Dear esteemed members of the jury, my name is Haider Eid, and I am an associate professor of literature and cultural studies at what used to be Al-Aqsa University in Gaza. And I'm speaking to you right now from Johannesburg, South Africa. I spent the first 2 months of the genocide in Gaza itself, where I was displaced 3 times. And after being evacuated by the South African embassy in Ramallah in December 2023, I went from Gaza to South Africa via Egypt. And South Africa has become my 4th displacement. And I want to begin by stating that it is extremely difficult to find an appropriate word that can describe and encompass the horror of what is happening in Gaza other than evil, an absolute evil, devoid of even the most minimal restrictions, controls, and deterrents, which, however superficial, sometimes succeed in curbing the savage evil that lurks beneath the surface and limiting its manifestations. This is an evil devoid of all frameworks and explanations that justify and rationalize its consequences and find excuses for it after the fact itself. Israeli political and military leaders have deliberately unleashed a genocidal war to wreak havoc on Gaza, my hometown, Gaza City, and I myself was born in the Nusayrat refugee camp, making Gaza unlivable, literally unlivable. Israel has severely punished Gaza's population, especially women, children, and the elderly, for daring to challenge its colonial invincibility. I was in Gaza when the deadly hermetic siege of 2006 was imposed and was meant to punish us Palestinians for voting against the Oslo Accords, for voting against the two-state solution, for voting for resistance in all its forms, or rather, as I said, for voting against the Oslo Accords and the so-called two-state solution. Even as the Israeli onslaught continued unabated over the years, it was 17 years later that October 7th presented Israel with the perfect opportunity to take its historically punitive approach towards Gaza to horrific, unprecedented new levels. The personal loss, and I'm supposed to be telling you about my personal experience, and I'm saying it very, very clearly, and I'm not in the habit of doing that. the personal loss has been too tremendous even to grasp. Personally, I have lost 54 relatives, cousins from the Eid clan, and I have lost 39 colleagues from Al-Aqsa University, and I have lost more than 280 students from our university, including some of my best students, literature students. I also have lost all my belongings, my flat, my neighborhood, my family home, my children's school at my university. 2 days before the implementation of the so-called ceasefire, Trump's Gaza plan, I had received a message from a friend who is still in southern Rimal, or rather what used to be Tel El Hawa. He wrote it while the Israeli genocidal forces were decimating Gaza City. And I want to quote what my friend sent to me. He said, "The world feels exceptionally dark tonight, and I'm struggling to breathe, to stand, to think. I feel like I'm floating through space, like I have lost my footing. Ask any other Gazan, and they likely feel the same. Utterly hopeless and bereft of words to describe this hell. This hell we are witnessing and that my family is experiencing right now. Our city, our beloved Gaza, our defiant Gaza that refuses to play by anyone's rules." Now, compare that to the percentage of children dead in the Ukraine conflict, which is 0.3%. And I want to quote also another South African, Navi Pillay, chair of the United Nations Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, including Eastern Jerusalem. Last month, she had this to say: "The goal of the Israeli government is abundantly clear, the destruction of life in Gaza. There's an escalating collective hysteria in Israel against everything Palestinian, which is a reflection of the ongoing racist implementation of Zionist ideology, as previous speakers have said. The implementation of Zionism on the ground since 1948, this ongoing genocide can be traced back to 1948. I am a son of refugees from the Zanuga village, which was ethnically cleansed back in 1948. Both my parents died in 2005, dreaming of the day when the United Nations Resolution 194 would be implemented, when they would be allowed to return to Zanuga. That unfortunately did not happen. The fact that Israel is a settler colonial state essentially means that, like any other settler colonial state, it is based on either the total extermination of the indigenous population and or ethnic cleansing. Thank you so much."
That was the testimony of Dr. Haider Eid, Associate Professor of Literature and Cultural Studies at what used to be Al-Aqsa University in Gaza, before apartheid Israel destroyed it, delivered at the Gaza Tribunal final session held in Istanbul, Turkey in October 2025. At the same Gaza Tribunal final session, Dr. Javid Abdelmanem, emergency medicine physician and Medecins Sans Frontières International president, spoke about destruction of healthcare system bearing witness to genocide in Gaza. He bears witness to Israel's deliberate mass harm of civilians use of food as a weapon of war, and destruction of healthcare system as three key elements in its genocide in Gaza. Let's listen to his remarks.
My name is Dr. Javed Abdelmounem. I'm an emergency medicine physician and the Médecins Sans Frontières Doctors Without Borders International President, MSF. I was in Gaza from the 6th of June to the 31st of July 2024 as a medical team leader. My account today relies on that experience as well as MSF's work throughout the last 2 years. MSF is an independent medical humanitarian organization. We deliver care to people affected by conflict, epidemics, and disasters, and we speak out about what we witness. We've worked in Palestine since 1988. In Gaza today, over 1,000 of my Palestinian colleagues and around 40 international staff support hospitals, clinics, and water provision. Distinguished jury of conscience, please consider that we bear witness to Israel's deliberate mass harm of civilians, use of food as a weapon of war, and destruction of the healthcare system as three key elements in its genocide in Gaza, which takes place in the historical context of the Israeli occupation, colonization, blockade, and forced displacement of Palestinians across the occupied Palestinian territories. We witnessed mass deliberate harm of civilians through killing and injury. During my time in Gaza, in the so-called safe humanitarian zone, Al-Mawasi, makeshift tents crowded to the shoreline, gunships fired on the coastline while drones, helicopters, and jets were constant overhead. Explosions shook our windows and smoke plumes rose across the north, middle, and south simultaneously. Over a span of just 9 days in July 2024, I worked through four mass casualty events in the emergency room of Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. Four Israeli attacks resulted in 162 people killed and 568 injured, those figures just from one emergency room, the one in which I worked. Two of those attacks were within the so-called humanitarian zone. One of those attacks employed a double tap, whereby the first responder medical teams who arrived on the scene were also struck. I treated those patients that day, many of them still in their ambulance and first responder uniforms. In the middle of one of those four mass casualties, I saw our MSF anesthetist in the emergency room instead of the operating theater. He explained his house had been destroyed and his daughters and nephews were in the ER somewhere. Later, we learned one of his nephews had been killed and another had suffered a spinal injury and paralysis. Within the next 5 days, my nurse colleague's son was killed, living in the middle area, and another nurse colleague living in Gaza City had two children killed and his third severely injured. Jury, please consider how the Israeli attacks were so indiscriminate through disregard for civilians that death became routine. Nearly every day, our wards echoed with the cries of my healthcare colleagues who were told that their family members had just been killed in their homes or while playing outside. Please note one scene I experienced working in the red zone in the emergency room during a mass casualty, which captures a glimpse of the daily horrific reality in Gaza. A three-year-old girl injured, looking straight at me. She's breathing and alert, but when I remove her dressing, her entire left thigh is peeled down to the bone. Next to her, a woman covered in dust, appearing stable, breathing, eyes open, no obvious bleeding, until I took down the dressing and a large piece of bowel emerged. I kneel over a boy, blood on my knee, in his early teens on the floor, no facial hair yet. He's dead, not breathing. A man, most of his lower leg mangled, a boy with his face almost entirely burnt, a woman whose entire back is burnt with shrapnel and melted clothing. A girl taking her last breaths alone. At least she had the dignity to be on a bed. These are just seven of the 730 injured or killed in 9 days in one emergency room in which I worked a year ago, and the same violence has continued every week that there hasn't been a ceasefire. Members of the jury, I would also like you to consider that during my time in Gaza in June 2024, the Nusayrat hostage rescue produced catastrophic civilian casualties, something I witnessed with my own eyes. The disproportion between the 4 Israelis rescued and the nearly 980 Palestinians killed and wounded that day is an affront to humanity. The entire trauma system was overwhelmed from middle area to south. In our trauma unit in Nasser alone, we took in 19 patients transferred from Al-Aqsa Hospital. The last child admitted from that attack was discharged 42 days later from our ward. He'd suffered an amputated forearm, a brain injury with memory loss and seizures, and still had a metal external fixator attached to his femur. Less than 7 days after that attack, as I waited to cross the Netzarim corridor, I witnessed the murder of 2 fishermen on the beach. This was roughly 2 kilometers from the buffer zone. Each was killed with a single shot from behind as they ran away, one to the neck and one to the heart. Israeli authorities denied us permission to render first aid or retrieve the bodies. Their friends crept up the beach, retrieved the bodies, and carried them away, still clutching one of their fishing nets. 2, how Israeli authorities used food as a weapon of war. The deliberate use of food as a weapon in Gaza saw hunger reach unprecedented levels, with famine confirmed by the IPC in August 2025, as you've heard. This is not hunger, it's deliberate starvation. At the MSF clinic in Gaza City, in the north of the Strip, the number of people enrolled for malnutrition by the second week of July had quadrupled in the previous month, while rates of severe malnutrition in children under 5 tripled in 2 weeks of July alone. In Gaza City, as of August the 9th, we had 1,599 people enrolled for outpatient malnutrition treatment. 42% of those children are under 5 years old, and over half are pregnant and breastfeeding women. A week-long survey at our clinics across Gaza this July showed a quarter of pregnant and breastfeeding women and children were malnourished. Our 4 outpatient feeding centers were overwhelmed, facing demand driven by deliberate starvation. Members of the jury, during this time, people were forced to seek food at the Israeli and UN-led militarized food distribution sites run by the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Fund, GHF. Distributions at GHF sites were accompanied by extreme violence. Palestinian men, women, and children seeking food came under fire from Israeli soldiers and from American security contractors. Our teams on the ground treated people with gunshot wounds, barbed wire lacerations, and crush injuries from stampedes, all sustained while trying to receive aid at GHF sites. Between 7th of June and 24th of July 2025, in just 6.5 weeks, in just 2 of our facilities, we received 1,380 injured individuals and 28 dead from 2 GHF sites. The anatomical precision of those injuries suggests intentional targeting rather than indiscriminate fire. And this is only a fraction of the total injured and killed seeking food aid at GHF sites. These are just the patients we saw in our own clinics. Esteemed jury, our colleague Abdullah Hamad was killed on the 3rd of July this year. Israeli forces deliberately targeted a group of people, including Abdullah, without warning as they waited for aid trucks to collect flour in Khan Yunis. Jury, we highlight that the famine and deaths at food aid sites were not accidental. They were deliberately orchestrated by Israel. 3, on the destruction deliberately of the healthcare system. Medical facility closures and direct attacks on health infrastructure. In the space of 8 days in July last year, while I worked in Gaza, Israel's evacuation orders resulted in the closure of 13 medical points, 4 primary healthcare centers, and 3 hospitals. This included our MSF Gaza clinic, one of the only functioning clinics for wound care in the north, and the Ministry of Health European Gaza Hospital in the south. That last closure resulted in an influx of patients to Nasser Hospital where I was working. Families wheeled their injured loved ones on their hospital beds, kilometers from hospital to try to get them care that day. From October 23 until September of this year, MSF evacuated staff and patients from 24 health facilities. We've endured 50 violent attacks, including airstrikes on hospitals, tank fire on deconflicted shelters, and attacks on convoys. On the 25th of August this year, Nasser was targeted again with a double tap airstrike. It's the only partially functioning hospital left in southern Gaza. That attack killed 21 people, including healthcare workers and journalists, and one of our MSF staff sustained injuries to his chest. The jury should consider that Nasser is just one of many hospitals hit across the strip. Since the 9th of August this year, there is not one single fully functioning hospital remaining in Gaza. Currently, only 14 of 36 are partially operational. On the systematic obstruction of medical supplies and equipment. Immediately following the Rafah invasion in early May of 24, medical supplies arriving from outside became minimal to non-existent. At MSF inside Nasser, as I worked, we ran out of ibuprofen, gloves, even wheelchairs and crutches. We had to borrow surgical gowns and lacked enough mattresses for beds in the MSF burns and orthopedic trauma wards. The jury should consider that in the first 7 days of July 2024, health services received less than 9% of our fuel needs. This triggered electricity rationing that at times meant no water on the wards until 2 p.m., no electricity in the inpatient areas, no sterilization services, and repeated power limits in operating theaters. At a time of influx of wounded from mass casualties every other day, for example, 6 surgeries had to be cancelled in a single day because surgical staff could not work without electricity. Jury, please note that Israeli procedures for authorizing and managing the entry of essential supplies into Gaza were and continue to be inefficient, arbitrary, and marred by blockages and delays. Only 2/3 of our supply requests have been accepted since October 2023. An average response time in these 2 years is 83 days for medical items and 64 for logistical. Some items take over 300 days to be approved by Israel. These obstructions prevented life-saving surgery and care. Last year, we recorded an 18% wound infection rate in 6 of our clinics. Healthcare workers systematically targeted. Over 1,700 healthcare workers have been killed since October 2023. At MSF, 15 of our colleagues have been killed by Israeli forces in Gaza. Moreover, our colleagues were displaced multiple times, starved and maimed. Dear jury, take note that Drs. Mohammed Abu Nujaila and Ahmed Al-Sahar, MSF doctors working in Al-Awda Hospital, were killed when the facility was struck in November 2023. We had repeatedly informed Israeli authorities that Al-Awda was a working hospital with patients and medical staff and therefore protected under international humanitarian law. A few days earlier, our colleague Ala Ashawa, a nurse, was killed when a clearly marked MSF convoy came under attack in Gaza City, despite having authorization to evacuate. He was shot in the head. 2 years of Israeli raids on hospitals have resulted in arbitrary detention, torture, and forced disappearance of health workers, including MSF staff. On October 26th last year, during a raid on Kamal Adwan Hospital, MSF surgeon Dr. Mohammed Obeid was arrested with 57 others. To this day, he remains in an Israeli prison without charge, cut off from his family, and has lost significant weight. On the destruction of water and sanitation system. Beyond the healthcare system itself, jury, please be mindful that the water and sanitation system, integral for the public health of the population, has been destroyed by Israel. In June 2024, a UN assessment of the water and sanitation system revealed over 100 kilometers of the sewage network and 60% of the sanitation system destroyed, including the totality of all heavy machinery needed to manage solid waste. Less than 1/3 of the fuel needs for desalination pumps and water trucks were allowed by Israel that month. This all, coupled with the serial displacement of the population and breakdown of vaccination programs, meant that polio was declared in Gaza while I was there. It had been eradicated years previously. In our primary care clinics, top diagnoses were water and sanitation related, diarrhea, skin, and eye infections. People lacked clean water, toilets, soap, and disinfectants. Members of the jury, a health system does not collapse by chance. It's destroyed when hospitals are deliberately struck, supplies are choked off, healthcare workers are killed or detained, and the water and sanitation system is ruined. As Gaza's health infrastructure collapsed, civilians are left without life-saving care. Patients with trauma injuries, chronic diseases, cancer, communicable illnesses, malnourished children, and pregnant women are dying from preventable causes. I ask you to recognize this for what it is, the deliberate dismantling of the means to survive. Conclusion. Deliberate mass harm to civilians, food as a weapon of war, destruction of the healthcare system. Under these headings, I've described Israeli actions that in our witnessing and experience reflect a systematic and deliberate pattern of destruction targeting the population in Gaza. The genocide is far from over. Aid is still not flowing in at scale. A humanitarian catastrophe continues to unfold, and there remains an urgent need for credible accountability mechanisms to deliver justice for the thousands and killed and injured by Israeli actions over the past 2 years. Thank you.
That was Dr. Javed Abdelmanaim, Emergency Medicine Physician and Médecins Sans Frontières International President, speaking at the Gaza Tribunal final session held in Istanbul, Turkey, in October 2025. As I mentioned previously on this program, on December 30, 2025, apartheid Israel decided to ban 37 international humanitarian organizations from doing any work in the Gaza Strip, including Doctors Without Borders and Médecins Sans Frontières, in an attempt to speed up the genocide it is inflicting on the Gaza Strip, and another way to prevent anyone from the outside world to see what Israel is doing to the 2.3 million Palestinians inside the Gaza Strip. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.